Good morning, I'm Hugh LaFollette. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is Stephen Schwartz, editor and co-author of the book Atomic Audit, Costs and Consequences, published last June by Brookings Institution Press. Stephen, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The book I see a draft of in front of me at the time of this taping is quite a substantial piece of work. I think you said in roughly 700 pages of information. Why do such a study on the cost of nuclear weapons? I mean, in a lot of people's minds, it's almost a passé question.
Well, when we started in 1994, the issue was, could we find out what had been spent on the U.S. nuclear weapons program in toto? We were interested in what other countries had spent, but we felt like we didn't have enough expertise or information available on, for example, Russia's or the former Soviet Union's program or the programs of Britain or France or China in order to do an effective audit. And given the secrecy problems in a lot of those countries and the lack of data, we just decided to focus on the United States. But the issue really was, what did we get for all of this money that we spent? We knew that it was a lot of money, but nuclear weapons, you know, arguably were the centerpiece of the Cold War, were the centerpiece of U.S. national security, and really still are in many respects. And yet, there has never been any discussion or analysis of what was spent on them. You know, did we get a bigger bang for the buck? Did it really pay off in that respect? And so we wanted to try to answer that question. What we found out, surprisingly, was that besides us, nobody else had ever attempted to answer this question, and only a few people had ever really asked it. And in fact, the government only once ever tried to calculate the cost, and they did it in a very partial way and effectively gave up after a couple of years, deciding that it was just too difficult and not worth it.
Okay. Let's begin by looking at some of the things that you uncover in the book about the cost. Obviously, the first sense of cost is the monetary cost. What's the bottom line? What has it cost the United States to develop, maintain, deliver nuclear weapons, or have them able to be delivered?
Right, right. The total cost to date, the total incurred costs, let's say, or I'm sorry, let me back up. The total costs to date are about $5.5 trillion, and that's in adjusted 1996 dollars, so we've adjusted them to take out the effects of inflation. So a dollar in 1990 is worth the same as a dollar in 1950. If you add in the costs of managing and cleaning up the nuclear waste that resulted from the production of 70,000 nuclear warheads over the last 50-odd years, and if you add in the anticipated cost of dealing with the management and disposal of surplus fissile materials from retired nuclear weapons, plutonium, highly enriched uranium, you're looking at about $5.8 trillion. And just to give your listeners a sense of how much money that is, if you took that amount of money and you converted it into bricks of $1 bills, like you can go and get at the bank, a brick of $1 bills is $200. It's about, it's an inch high. If you took those bricks and you circled the Earth, laid them end to end, they would circle more than 100 times around the Earth at the equator. And the height of the wall that you would create would be more than 8 feet high. So you're talking about a substantial amount of money. It's enough money, basically, to give everybody living in the United States at the beginning of 1998 about $21,000.
Okay. Is a fair amount of money. Now, when you talk about that amount of money, I mean, $5.5 trillion appears to be an enormous amount. If you looked at the budget of the federal government in particular year, they're going to have some sort of figure about the cost of constructing nuclear weapons.
Actually, they don't.
Oh, okay.
No, actually, the government has never, ever tallied the costs of nuclear weapons in a form that anybody could understand.
Okay.
And that's one of the principal findings of the study, is that the government really doesn't know what it is that we spend. They haven't asked, and they haven't bothered to find out.
Okay. I would have thought there was at least some sort of figure about the cost of building them, period.
You would think, yes.
But that there are substantial other costs involved in maintaining the nuclear threat.
Right.
Which you try to lay out and explain in your book. Perhaps you could talk about some of those additional costs.
Sure, sure. But let me just get to that other point.
Okay.
The costs of building the warheads themselves are relatively transparent only because all of that work was done by the Atomic Energy Commission, now the Department of Energy, and their budgets have been relatively open. So we know, for example, what they spent on an annual basis. We don't know where all the money went. We don't know how much was spent, for example, to produce warheads versus other activities that they were doing, but that's fairly well known. But that's only a portion of the money. I mean, we only spent about, only relatively speaking, about $400 billion to build 70,000 warheads and conduct 1,030 nuclear weapons tests and do all the things necessary to actually build up the arsenal. But then when it comes to deploying the weapons, to put them on missiles and on submarines and on bombers and on artillery shells and on nuclear landmines and all that kind of stuff, all that was handled by the Department of Defense, and none of that has ever been publicly available before. So we have to kind of root around and find information, get information from the Department of Defense. But even though we have it, our estimate, and it is just an estimate at the end of the day, is only sort of the floor, if you will. It's probably much, much more. We had to make some very conservative assumptions, for example, about how much was spent, for example, integrating nuclear weapons into our conventional forces. And the reality is that I'm sure we spent more money than we estimated, but we don't know because the Department of Defense never tracked it.
Okay, so your figure is a conservative figure.
Very, very, very conservative. We spent, based on the data that we were able to assess, we spent about 30% of the military budget since 1940 went to nuclear weapons. That's a significant amount of money. It's more money than the government has ever acknowledged and probably more than most people realize. In terms of how that breaks out overall with all other government spending, because it's a relevant question to ask, well, obviously, you know, nuclear weapons didn't cost as much. Somebody actually sent me an email last year and said, well, that's a lot of money, but we spend more money on interest on the national debt. Turns out that we didn't actually. If you rank nuclear weapons spending against all other forms of government spending from 1940 through 1996, which was our effective cutoff date, nuclear weapons cost more than everything else except for all other national defense and Social Security. So you're talking about interest on the debt, you're talking about education, you're talking about the environment, you're talking about foreign aid, you're talking about welfare programs, you know, broadly defined. Agriculture, anything else you can think of, we spent more on nuclear weapons than all of that. So, you know, the question is, did we get our money's worth? Did it actually contribute to our national security? Did it prevent World War III? We can get into those issues, but you asked a question earlier about the other costs. We effectively tried to look at the nuclear weapons program from the beginning to the end. So we started with, the research that developed into the Manhattan Project during World War II, that then led to the mass production of nuclear weapons following the war. We then segue into the deployment of nuclear weapons on bombers and missiles and submarines and so forth. We move into the command and control systems, all the systems, the spinal cord, if you will, of U.S. nuclear infrastructure to make sure that the weapons will work when you want them to and that they don't go off when you don't want them to. The intelligence apparatus to understand what your adversary is doing so that you don't get surprised, as we were with India's recent nuclear test, or also to provide nuclear targeting information for your military forces. We look at defending against nuclear weapons, so ballistic missile defense, anti-satellite weapons, civil defense, things like that, anti-submarine warfare. We look then, those are sort of all the money that has been spent. Then we look at sort of the future costs, things that are now coming due, dismantling nuclear weapons, verifying arms control agreements, managing and disposing of nuclear waste, victims of the bomb. We have a chapter on that that looks at U.S. citizens and other people harmed by U.S. nuclear weapons activities. We looked at the high cost of nuclear secrecy, which is something a lot of people don't understand. Then we look at the congressional oversight, or lack thereof, of the nuclear weapons program since its beginnings. And then we close out with a discussion of the economic implications of nuclear deterrence and some recommendations for the future.
Okay. Let's look at a couple of the additional costs that you mentioned, specifically, too. You just talked about the environmental cost and the health costs.
Sure. Well, the environmental costs are very, very large. In fact, the costs of dealing with nuclear waste resulting from weapons production will be, we expect, about the same as it cost to actually build the weapons in the first place. Now, it didn't have to be that way. The reason why it is so expensive, the reason why we are looking at a cleanup program stretching well into the next century, 2070 or beyond, is that we basically ignored the problem for 40 years. The attitude beginning with the Manhattan Project was that we need to produce nuclear weapons as quickly as possible, and anything that gets in the way of that, that siphons money away from things that could be spent on production, is bad. And so we did the absolute minimal that we could get away with. And the situation in Russia was worse. They ended up having no laws at all restricting what they could do, and they've got a much, much bigger problem than we do. But basically, we just said, you know, let's worry about the waste later. Well, later never came until the late 1980s, when the nuclear weapons complex started to collapse, and people started paying attention to this, and the public started getting concerned that these weapons, which were supposedly designed to protect them, were in fact harming them and destroying their environment. So we're looking at a cleanup bill of about, it's hard to know for sure, but about $365 billion or so. We've already spent about $40 billion on that, so you're getting close to the $400 billion that we spent to actually build the weapons. And as I said, it's going to take many, many decades to do. And it's not at all clear how we're going to do this. We don't know, and the costs are very uncertain because we don't really know where all the contamination is. A lot of materials were just dumped during the production process. We took waste and just scattered them out in, you know, these large reservations, put them in cardboard boxes and buried them in shallow trenches, or just disposed of liquid waste in the soil and let it percolate down to the ground, thinking that, well, if we just, it'll bind with the soil and it won't go anywhere. And that didn't turn out to be the case. So that's where we stand with the quote-unquote cleanup program. As far as the victims, that is something that was also tended to be overlooked. The attitude was that, and we see the same thing now happening, unfortunately, in India, that we, the people running this program, the government officials, know better than you, the public, who are after all paying for this and are being quote-unquote protected by it, what is right. And even though there might be some risks involved in, for example, testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere or producing plutonium or uranium, that, you know, it's nothing to worry about, and in any event, it's better in the long run that we build these weapons to protect you. But the problem was that those same officials knew that what they were doing was very, very dangerous. In fact, we uncovered some documentation right around the time that the Nevada test site opened up in 1951, where after the government had spent a couple of years trying to find a location and effectively ruled out anywhere that would keep fallout from wafting across the United States, they settled on Nevada, knowing that it would contaminate the rest of the country, purely because it was close to Los Alamos National Laboratory, which was then our only nuclear weapons lab, and therefore it was expedient to build it there. The government owned the land, they'd build it, it would be great. But when the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, Gordon Dean, asked the staff director of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, which was the congressional committee overseeing nuclear weapons programs at the time, a few days before they were set to announce the creation of the test site, Dean asked the staff director, he said, so what are the people on the committee think about the test site? And the staff director responded, well, some of them are glad that they don't live anywhere near it. They understood what the problems were, and they kept the public in the dark about it for years and years and years, saying that there isn't any risk, you know, if you get fallout on you, don't worry, wash it off. Well, the result is now that we are paying a very large bill in the form of compensation to people, in the form of cleaning up fallout and so forth. We're looking at, we have something called the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which is, you know, depending on the people you talk to, somewhat flawed in its implementation, but it allows for people to be compensated if they can prove to the government that they have been harmed by fallout from nuclear weapons tests. And we spent a couple billion dollars on that. More importantly, as a result of all the testing activities that we had out in the Pacific at Bikini Atoll and Eniwetok, we have spent close to $800 billion compensating those islanders for the harm that we caused to them in terms of relocating them, in terms of providing them with agricultural subsidies, in terms of giving them cash payments that will allow them, you know, in the absence of their islands, which they lived on for many, many years before we came there, to basically eke out an existence. So, and again, these costs are not going away. It's only beginning to be understood what the consequences were, for example, of testing with nuclear weapons in the atmosphere in the United States, or the consequences of not being more careful when we're producing nuclear weapons materials at various places around the country. So we're not out of the woods yet.
Okay, one of the other costs, which you did mention earlier, and it ties in with the point you just made, has to do with secrecy and what you identify as the cost to democracy. Could you explain what you mean by that? What was the nature of the secrecy, and how does it cost democracy?
Right. Well, nuclear secrecy costs come in two flavors. There are the tangible costs, and then there are intangible costs. The tangible costs are things like the fact that the Atomic Energy Act stipulated that basically all nuclear weapons information was born secret. So even if you were outside of the government, you know, I could be having a conversation and, you know, we could theorize about a nuclear weapon design and we could talk about something. That information could in and of itself be classified. The fact that we did it and created it outside of the government doesn't in any way affect the fact that it's classified under that law. Because everything related to nuclear weapons was classified for many, many years, and this is only beginning to be rolled back in the last couple of years, there are enormous costs associated with keeping it secret. You have, for example, today you have separate telephone and fax lines and computer lines to deal with classified information. If you have to send classified information from one location to another, there's a courier that accompanies with it, and it has to go by in a special locked pouch, for example, or a special truck. You have separate filing cabinets. You have separate buildings sometimes to deal with this stuff. There are physical barriers around all this material. There are regular inventories of all this material. The Department of Energy today has, they estimate, and this is just a guess on their part, about 280 million classified documents, and every single one of those has to be tracked. Now, sometimes they lose track of them, but it does cost a lot of money to maintain that system, and it's inefficient as well. If anybody who has any experience with the Freedom of Information Act, for example, we've got a document, actually it's not in the book, but we uncovered it, where one of our co-authors was trying to get some information on the deployment of intermediate range missiles to Europe in the 1960s. And he got a document from the National Archives that was a congressional report to President Kennedy about a visit that the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy had made to one of these missile sites. And it said, we visited the missile sites in Italy and Turkey. Well, he got the same document a few years later from the Department of Energy, and the words Italy and Turkey were deleted, even though it has been known for decades where those weapons were and what those weapons were and when they were there. And yet some classifier at the Department of Energy saw fit to classify the norm. That all has enormous costs. Those are the tangible costs. The intangible costs are things like what was the impact on U.S. economic competitiveness, for example, for not having access to some of this information that might have actually benefited us had it not been secret? Or what are the consequences to foreign policy, for example? The U.S. has a longstanding policy of neither confirming nor denying the location or absence of nuclear weapons in any particular place, even historically, to the point that officials will go to great pains to deny things or to refuse to comment on things that are already widely known. This practice led, beginning in the 1960s, to something called the nuclear allergy, which first started in Japan, which had obvious reasons for being concerned about nuclear weapons, and then spread to Europe. And as I'm sure you and many of your listeners recall, in the mid-1980s, New Zealand and other countries got very, very concerned about this policy and effectively set up barriers to try to force the United States to acknowledge whether or not it was bringing nuclear weapons onto their territory. And the United States refused to play along, and it ended up severing relations with, for example, diplomatic relations with New Zealand, and got into some hot water with Sweden and some other countries as well. The consequences of that were pretty severe at the time, and it wasn't necessarily a bad thing for New Zealand, but it was hard for the United States, and it was hard for New Zealand to deal with, and the same thing with Japan. So that's an example of the tangible costs, and there's many, many others that we document.
Okay, we've taken about the first two-thirds just outlining the cost. Let's talk about the consequences. Maybe the way to approach it is for you to try to give a snapshot view of what you take the consequences to be, perhaps of the implications and lessons we can draw from this, And then we can look at maybe at least a couple of them in more detail.
Sure. Well, the I think one of the biggest consequences that we have to look at is, was this program well managed? Did the people who were running it understand at the time what they were doing, what they were spending, what they were getting for the money that they were spending? And the answer that we came up with after looking at all of this is no. We spent more than we needed to. We built more than we needed to. We ended up wasting a lot of money on things like nuclear-powered airplanes and nuclear-powered cruise missiles and the thousands of weapons that we deployed to Europe in the 1950s on the assumption it would be less expensive to do that than to have a large conventional force to keep the Soviet Union from invading Western Europe. And because the costs of the program were never understood, and really until our book have never been understood, there was never any way to have an effective public or congressional debate about what we were doing. I mean, you can argue that, you know, okay, well, a lot of money was wasted, but sure, a lot of money was wasted on welfare programs, for example. I don't deny that. But the difference is that you can go to government budget documents and find out what we're spending on welfare programs anytime you want. You can find out what we've spent historically, what we're going to spend in the future. Congress debates the issue on a regular basis. And in fact, we've spent more money on nuclear weapons than we have in welfare programs. So at least the opportunity for waste is easily as great as it would be for welfare programs. But because people didn't understand what we were spending, you couldn't have the kind of debate about, well, okay, are we spending money on the right things? Are we spending too much? Are we spending too little? What are we getting for it? No, we couldn't have any of that discussion. And so what we're left with at the end of the day is the belief that the Cold War ended. We obviously didn't have a nuclear war. There's a belief widespread that we won the Cold War, although it's unlike any other war that we fought, and that the loser has as many weapons as the winner, and we've still got to deal with the consequences of that. But the bottom line for us is that had people known what it was that we were spending, had they known the full consequences of that spending to the economy, to the environment, to the health of the people that this program was designed to protect, then I think we would have had a very different program. People would have said, wait a minute. Why are you building 70,000 warheads? Why are you building 6,000 ballistic missiles? Why do you need 4,700 strategic bombers? All that was classified, and not only was it classified, but the numbers weren't even known, so we could never have that debate. But I think it's important to start having that debate now, particularly in light of what India and Pakistan are doing, because I think they are looking to us, in some sense, as the model for how this program can be run. And if they do, I think they're in for a rude surprise because it's a lot more expensive than anybody understands.
Okay, how would you describe your recommendations? Your recommendations and the recommendations of your group?
Well, the principal recommendation would be that the government has to do an atomic audit by itself every year. We want to get legislation passed that would mandate the collection of this data through the Office of Management and Budget, which is a relatively effective agency that does this kind of work anyway for the government in reconciling the various requests from various departments as the budget is prepared every year, and presenting that information to the public and to Congress so that every year we can see what it is that we spent the previous year, what it is that we're spending the current fiscal year, and what we're projecting to spend. And we could see, for example, if such an audit were ran today, we could see that the Department of Energy is proposing to actually spend more money on what used to be called nuclear weapons research, development, and testing than it did during the Cold War, even though we're not building any new weapons and we're not planning on testing any weapons. And although the Department of Energy denies this, the fact is that we are planning on spending more. And as people understand that, they rightly want to know why. You know, if the Cold War is over, if we're decreasing our arsenal, if we're interested in getting rid of weapons, if we're telling India and Pakistan not to go and build weapons, why are we spending more on that category? Yeah. The other recommendation would be that the public needs to get more involved in understanding these issues. Granted, a lot of this information is still classified, but I think we have seen, for example, where people do get involved and concerned about things, for example, nuclear fallout or the effect of deploying intermediate-range missiles in Europe in the 1980s, that government officials take notice. And it's not enough to say the Cold War is over, we don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. We're looking again at a cleanup program that is going to stretch into many decades. We're looking at nuclear weapons that are still on hair trigger alert. We're still spending $35 billion a year on all of this stuff. That's a lot of money. That's 14% of the defense budget. Money that could be spent on other things if we wanted to. So those are the two key ones. You know, we basically just want people to be more informed and more aware of where their tax dollars are going.
Okay. You mentioned India and Pakistan. Obviously, at the time of this taping, it's a hot issue. We've now had two other countries that have carried out nuclear tests. What or how could your work illuminate our understanding of what happened or how we ought to respond to what happened in India and Pakistan?
I think the important thing to realize, and because we used cost as sort of a prism to look at the program, we offer a very unique perspective on it. It's important to realize that the way the Cold War turned out was not necessarily the way that it was supposed to turn out. I mean, there were many points in time where we thought that we might come to blows, the Cuban Missile Crisis being only the most obvious one. But if people understand that the program was that nuclear weapons, for example, are inherently dangerous, that the postures that we developed, that the money that we spent actually contributed to the problem rather than alleviating it, I think we can start to get away from the notion that somehow, even though we spent a lot of money, that this was all worth it, that we managed to come out okay. There were many points in time where we might not have come out okay. And if India and Pakistan look to our example, I think it's akin to saying, well, you know, we walked across thin ice and we made it to the other side. I don't think that that's likely to happen in their case. They're next-door neighbors. They fought three wars with each other. If they were to deploy weapons on missiles, they're looking at flight times of about 3-5 minutes, which gives them basically no warning time. You know, we at least had the luxury at the beginning of the Cold War, first of all, having a monopoly on nuclear weapons, and second of all, having the only means of delivery being bombers that took hours and hours to reach their targets. And so we were able to, our nuclear policy was able to mature with the weapons technology. Today, there is not that luxury, and the possibility of something igniting over there is pretty severe.
Could you explain that real quickly, the idea of why the flight time is so important? Maybe unclear to some listeners.
Sure. Well, in the United States, for example, we have early warning radars and satellites and so forth that indicate to us if something is ever launched at us. And our policy has been for a long time that if we receive definite indications of a launch, that we are going to launch on warning, a launch under attack, because we cannot be sure that our command and control system will actually survive. The weapons might survive, but the means of launching them might not. And under the logic of deterrence, in order to prevent that attack from happening in the first place, you have to threaten to stop it before it even starts. With India and Pakistan, you're looking at a missile, if it goes up from India or from Pakistan, it could reach its target in 3 minutes, in 5 minutes. That means that if you're a national leader in India or Pakistan, you might have 30 seconds to make a decision, assuming that you actually have an early warning apparatus to let you know that something's been launched, which they don't have. But if they did, let's say you're sitting there in New Delhi or whatever, or Islamabad, you get a call. They've launched a missile. What are you going to do? How can you make a rational decision in 30 seconds? What if it's a false alert and you launch? Well, then you've obliterated your opponent for no good reason and perhaps ignited a nuclear war.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing in the show.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Stephen Schwartz, editor and co-author of Atomic Audit, Costs and Consequences, published by Brookings Institution. This is Hugh LaFalk, Fridays and Issues. Good day.